Welcome to My Safety Tech Podcast with me, your host, Pete Thomas. Duncan, how are you this morning?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Bright and sunny in Newcastle for a very pleasant change. So perked up by the flowers blooming and the sun shining.
Amazing. Feel free to introduce yourself slightly if you wish, and please tell us about Notify.
Yeah, sure. Well, so I'm obviously Duncan Davies. I guess a bit about me. I've got a degree in psychology, so always been fascinated in human behavior, trained as a chartered accountant with PwC a long, long time ago now, then went to Sage Software, big success story in the Northeast, where I got into M&A work, joined a business called TSG, one of the largest Microsoft and Sage partners in the UK, and became an FD there at age 30. So I'm an accountant, sometimes I'm a recovering accountant by background. We did about 25 acquisitions. We grew to about 500 people. So being on that side of the fence, been quite interesting on a compliance angle. Left about age 40, wanted to do something different, challenge myself. Worked in some really interesting tech companies, autonomous cars, software as a service, even online bingo. At age 43, started Notify with my co-founder, Andy Dumbell. And we sort of, I think the thing that we saw in that with what Notify, I guess, bringing us to what we do is an opportunity for technology to help fix what was a massive problem. And I remember reading this stat from the ILO, International Labour Organization, long ago, that every 15 seconds a worker's killed and 153 are injured or made ill, which is just staggering. Oh yeah, I was back in 2017, 2016. And that felt like a big problem to help solve. And with a technology background, I've always thought technology tools can help with things like that. So Notify is that project really of, we set ourselves a mission of making 1 billion people safer, and we want to help that through technology tools. And that's broadly how we set ourselves up. And there's probably some of the tech stuff we can get into, but ultimately we're an SHEQ digital platform that helps companies look after their people and keep them healthy.
That's great, Duncan. I mean, I think that's a really impressive and very moral mission to you know, help a billion people. And I have to say, I completely agree with you. I mean, I look at the HSE stats in terms of worker fatalities, and since I've worked in safety, they've not really changed that much. So we're looking at around 100, I think it was 135 fatalities in the UK in the workspace. In last year's HSE statistics. So, you know, I find it interesting. You look at it from, a global position, which I think is good with the ILO statistics, because I think that shows, you know, an even more significant picture. I think one thing that I take away already from what you've said is, you know, for me, when I look at it, those statistics haven't changed, and we're all working hard as safety professionals. We're all trying our best, but we do need something else. And I completely agree with you. I think tech is something else, and how we're going to start to solve this problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing, just to build on that point about the fatality number as well, Pete, is the injuries and the cost to society of the things that aren't fatalities. You know, there are thousands of events, and I've spoken to a lot of safety people who are very skeptical about what are reported as our injury rates in the UK. You know, that there's the labor force survey, there's obviously RIDDOR reporting, and then there's the stuff that never gets reported, you know, either because people are scared, because companies hide the information, or simply because people aren't educated that they should share it. So if you bring into that stat, and let's not forget, there's 135 families who have been absolutely, you know, destroyed by something that happened at work. And a few months ago, I actually put the list up. The HSE produced the list. They actually put the names and the ages and the occupations of these people. And in a technology business, it's really important for me to link to my people that it's not just zeros and ones we're doing. This is actually people whose lives are changed forever, and their families and their husbands and their wives and their kids. And you look at these names and you think, you know, these are sometimes 20-year-old people, interestingly more older people in that demographic having fatal injuries at work. So even that one statistic of 135 belies the whole, you know, pain and cost of what happens. And on top of that, you've got injuries and people not able to work and provide for their families, which even in the UK, which is perhaps more advanced than other economies, is still a huge cost, you know, billions of pounds of cost in that, in the UK alone.
Do you know, it's a great point, Duncan. Thank you for reminding me of that, because, you know, sometimes when you look at these statistics, and like you, I've looked through the demographics, I've looked through the names of the individuals involved. And I also, by the way, noticed that there were a lot of workers. I want to say the number was over 60 that were involved in those fatality statistics. But I think maybe sometimes I look at it so often, that number, that I sort of forget all everything else that goes along with it. And then you've got, you know, that is really is the tip of the iceberg. If you look at the number of people seriously injured, and then a statistic that people don't do is the number of people that are seriously injured and who later die by suicide as a result of their injury. You know, that's another element that no one's ever looked at. I mean, I've had the misfortune to be on a site where somebody died, and the impact was something that I hadn't really given consideration to, and it was something that I was pretty overwhelmed by. So in terms of people, the colleagues, the other staff on the site, with this person's friend, they were devastated. You know, the entire workforce was just devastated, and most actually never went back to work again in that company. Most just couldn't do it after that serious incident. So Duncan, I think you're absolutely right to point that out first thing, because that is the challenge, isn't it, that we're trying to overcome. And I think it's really important to identify that clearly.
And it probably talks to some of the challenges we have in safety about the messaging. So one of our founding fathers of Notify, a guy called Paul Wood, who kind of was at the very beginning of what Andy and I then turned into this business. He was the CEO of a very large logistics business, and he had one of his people were killed at work, and he had to go and talk to the widow of that person. And I remember him telling me this story on a train coming back from London. And you know what he said is, you never forget that. You never misunderstand how important safety is when you've had to sit opposite someone who has been killed at work, and you are the person that ran that company. Now, he is an individual, and the company wasn't found liable. They hadn't, you know, they were found not to be at fault. But in a sense, that didn't make a great deal of difference to him. He still had to go through what is a human experience of sitting down with somebody and ultimately apologizing, recognizing that he walks away to his, you know, his job, and this lady has lost a husband. And that, you know, what he's always said is, and until you've lived through that experience, sounds like you've had a similar thing, Pete, and unless you've lived through it, you don't actually know what that feels like. And part of what we're trying to do is not let people get to that point where they're having to go through that trauma, because it's like the ripples on a pond. It doesn't just affect the immediate workers. It changes all sorts of dynamics in a company, and obviously then the family of the person who's unfortunately killed or injured severely.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah.
And actually, though, I guess part of the tech bit is, and my background is, I'm from a compliance background with finance. You know, it's a similar stable, really. You've got rules, you've got regulations, you know your business should comply with them, and you spend a lot of your time trying to influence and coerce and carrot and stick to get people to do it. And I think, and I actually think one of the things that finance professionals started to nail, you know, a couple of decades ago was the messaging and the communication of the story. And I often think that with safety people is part of the stuff that we support is giving them the ammunition to have a hearts and minds conversation, because it is changing behavior is a hearts and minds game. The technology absolutely is a fantastically valuable tool. But what I see as doing is enabling and empowering people to have, you know, data-led discussions, but they are data-led discussions about, we do not want you to get hurt. And sometimes we need to have conversations with people about, and you need to change your behavior, or you need not to do these things, or you need to comply more. You know, so I have massive empathy for that, because I did it as an FD for 8 years, and I've dealt with, you know, that while it's boring, it takes too long, you're getting in my way, it would be so much easier if we didn't have to do it like this, and why do we have to, and all that. You know, I've sort of handled those in a finance way, which is not life and death. So I see safety people as superheroes. And I think you and I talked about this previously, Pete, of safety people also want to just get on with the job. You know, they don't want to be necessarily on the pedestal and front and center. At the same time, I think we undervalue them as they're often in it for the vocation of they care and they want to do a brilliant job. And I think the technology that we have and that is out there has such opportunity to help them get that influence and be front and center.
I'm going to interrupt this for 2 seconds just to tell you about a project. Now, I worked as a safety consultant for a long time, and I know how hard it is to get good quality leads, good clients. I set up a website and got literally no hits. The counter went to like 3 people and I was embarrassed. It was embarrassing how much money I spent on it for no one to ever find it. It was on like page 10 of Google Ads. And I spent a fortune on advertising in trade publications and never got any feedback, thousands of pounds. And then I had to spend money on making the advert. So I've set up mysafetyconsultant.io. It's a place where you, the seller, can interact directly with your customer. And everyone's welcome. If you're a fire safety consultant, a fire extinguisher technician, fire door inspector, well-being specialist, or if you're a safety software company that sells software to business owners, you're welcome to advertise on mysafetyconsultant.io. So please give it a go. Thank you. Yeah. And sometimes I fear that we don't necessarily get the basics right. And I'm one of the things that I'm really excited about with tech is that how it can help us to get the simple things right. You know, so say, for instance, risk assessment. The risk assessment process is fairly straightforward. I don't think anyone would look at it as a really complicated process.
Yeah.
But clearly, something's not perfect with that process when it's being executed. So one of the things that I'm really interested in is, say, we take risk assessment. How can tech help us to make that process better?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, a large part of this goes back to the whole pen, paper, process debate. So absolutely, I take your point. It is quite simple to do a risk assessment. And then people insist on printing them off and putting them in a binder on a site where somebody has to go and get them from the binder and then get a pen and fill them out. And then the risk assessment needs to be filed and then it needs to be searchable later on when somebody wants to check whether that risk assessment was suitable and sufficient, et cetera. So there are very simple ways that we can digitize processes like that to help deliver the compliance tool or the compliance document to where somebody is that doesn't involve them having to go into an office, open a lever arch file and enter it in ink. And then of course you've got the whole engagement piece. So one of my very early insights with Notify was I was sitting with a guy in Sunderland who, and their business, they fill potholes. So they have trucks that go out there and the chaps, and it was only men worked in this business, 30 people filled in potholes all over the UK. And they had a process for reporting near misses. And that process was you rang this bloke in Sunderland and you told him. And in the year that just before I spoke to them, they'd had 60 near miss reports across the 12 months. They downloaded our free app, which was Notify It at the time, in the January. And all he said to them, he got them in the office and he said, download this. And then when you're out working on the roads, because obviously they're obviously mobile, you know, if something happens, log it through this app, a very simple app. And in the 10 months to November, he had 400 near misses reported. So up from 60 a year to 40 a month. And that really was only about the way in which the person undertook the task. They were clearly motivated to let him know because he didn't bribe them. He didn't offer them money to report stuff. It was just putting in something in front of them that made it super easy to do. And I think that's one of the big, big benefits of technology is it can take something where it's not as engaging or it's time consuming. And it takes that and makes it super quick, which means that people engage. And because you've got some kind of technology platform, you can also reward and thank people for that engagement. So you've got this brilliant loop that you can create, which is, thank you for telling me. Here's what I've done about it. Thank you for telling me again. Here's what I've done about it. And we know time and again, when we speak to people in organizations, their big gripe about safety is, well, I reported this and nothing was done about it. There's a massive opportunity across lots of parts of safety to just fit that loop in that says, if you tell us stuff, we'll do something about it. And that creates a virtuous circle, I think. That's a really simple use case.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is simple, but I've seen it done wrong so many times. So, you know, near miss reports, I think when I worked back in a factory years ago, someone would have to write them down on paper and drop them in a box. And then people, of course, no one wanted to do that. So then they started rewarding it. Well, if you give us near misses, you know, whoever's done the most will get a £5 gift voucher. Oh, my God. You know, you can imagine you're just overwhelmed with paperwork for the sake of it. But none of it was about the people. The people wanted to create a safer workplace. Why wouldn't they? It was all about the efficiency of the process. And if you look at any tech now, like an app, it's just a race to make it more and more efficient. You know, even down to you download an app and you subscribe with Apple Pay. It's just about taking out the complexities of the process and making it more straightforward. And so I completely agree with you. It, you know, reporting near misses shouldn't be it's not a complicated process, but we make it more complicated. And then, like you say, we don't do anything about it. We don't give people feedback.
Yeah. And actually, and here's the thing in terms of how can safety people help more. It's that recognition, I think, that any kind of signal, and Amy Edmondson, who's written a cracking book called Right Kind of Wrong, she calls it ambiguous signals. Any kind of signal is valuable. What sometimes you'll find is that in the pursuit of compliance of, well, I need to know all this information, people will create a form, and it might even be digital, but they'll create a form which is full of detail and information. In the quite right urge to get lots of info, they'll create a unintentional barrier to the person filling it in versus what I think is the best approach, which is don't expect all your people to have safety insight and knowledge and understanding, but encourage them to give you the signals and get those signals. If they're ambiguous, then, you know, filter through them, and that becomes a new part of your role. But at least you've got, you know, a false alarm is 100% false alarm is still better than zero of something that is about to go badly wrong. And I've always had that view and had some good conversations with safety people about, you know, this overwhelming, well, we've got too many reports now. It's like, well, yeah, your next challenge is to start getting data literate and getting understanding about how you separate the wheat from the chaff. And that becomes a skill set that you need to learn, but you now at least have those signals coming in. And when they're valuable, you're rewarding them. And I mean reward in the sense of you're thanking people and you're making changes that help make people safer. And that's a massive motivator to most people, I think, in business.
Do you know what? This is I'm enjoying this conversation, Duncan. Data literate. This is a really interesting topic, and it's not something that it's something that I've thought a lot about, but it's not something that I've thought about in the following context, in that, you know, I went and did my master's degree. And some people have said to me, why did you do your master's degree and not a NEBOSH diploma? And I've always given the answer in the past that, well, a NEBOSH diploma, it can be very technical in terms of complexities of health and safety, such as air testing and air monitoring and definitions for things that are only relevant in factories or, you know, in certain situations. I just don't tend to work, you know, I tend to work with larger organizations, and I tend to have always worked with customer facing organizations, so like large retailers, large office, you know, real estate companies, but not necessarily those high risk industries, you know. So NEBOSH diploma didn't really work for me. But having heard what you've just said, I've realized that when I did the master's degree, it's about a research project, which is about data, and it's about data gathering, how you ask those questions, qualitative, quantitative, Likert scales, you know, how are you gonna collate the data? How are you gonna collect the data? How are you gonna collate it? How are you gonna select a sample size, you know, and how are you gonna analyze that data? And I just realized that actually in safety, we don't do that. Unless you've gone down an academic route. If you've gone down that sort of traditional NEBOSH, no one would go and do a NEBOSH certificate and learn about data. And then 2 minutes later, they're setting up an accident incident system, writing all the questions out that someone's going to have to answer. And they've not had the learning on how to write that in such a way that it makes it easy to analyze.
Yeah, I think you're well ahead then, Pete, because I honestly, it's a bit of a soapbox for me, but back to the scientific approach, right? We should all be being more scientific now. We kind of got that through COVID, right? We all sat and watched Chris Whitty and his charts, but we need safety professionals are going to have to get more data literate, even to the extent of things like near miss reporting. You know, you think of this, I think of it as a sort of steps, you start to identify a particular type of near miss that's increasing in frequency, and you need to understand frequency, and you need to understand a bit about statistics to know whether that is statistically relevant or whether they're one-offs. But then you're initiating a program that says, right, I'm going to go and handle that, I'm going to do some toolbox talks. And you should come up with a hypothesis that says, after I've done my toolbox talks, we are going to see a reduction in near misses. And then you should test that. And when you do it, you go, brilliant, I managed to do that. And so when I find the next near miss growing, because something else will inevitably become your next step, and you do the same again. And I think that the potential for people to use data to then influence hearts and minds is enormous. But because of the tech that we've now got, we're collecting lots of data, not just through systems like ours, but sensors and things like that in businesses. And safety people are going to have to get to an understanding where they can say what that means to the people that they need to influence in the business.
Yeah, and I think this is another interesting thing to sort of gain your insight on. You know, I've worked for a number of organizations, even up to FTSE level organizations that have only got a couple of hundred employees. You know, just because you've got a massive turnover doesn't mean you have to have a lot of employees.
Yeah.
And then in terms of the data and the level of data, there's, to me, you use the word hypothesis. I would say there's an insufficient sample size to evidence the hypothesis.
Yeah.
So what would happen is you have a near miss, and then we go, oh, we'll do a toolbox talk. How do you evidence the outcome of that toolbox talk without tech and without the ability for us to take many, many organizations, almost anonymize that data, put it in together and go, right, now you've got a sample size that you can work on?
Absolutely. And that is one of the challenges that's going to come on things like AI, I think, and analytics is you do need sufficient data to, you know, to do proper, I guess, statistics and analysis. Equally, when I talk about hypothesis, I'm also talking about things like, you know, what we do in marketing of, I'm gonna go and do this campaign, and I think I will get 50 leads from this campaign. Well, we got 40. Well, what did we learn from that? So I guess I haven't got a master's, so I defer to your knowledge on that, Pete. But in my sense, it's a bit of a proxy for the test and learn approach, which is really, really trendy, for want of a better word, in technology. And it's how we build our tech. It's minimum viable product, launch that, see if people like it, then deliver, build more, etc. And in the same way, I think safety professionals can learn from that approach of, I'm going to try something, but I'm going to set out in advance what I think it will deliver, and then I'm going to hold myself to account. And the way that technology can help support that is just, you can measure it much more quickly than in the olden days when it was, you know, spreadsheet or pieces of paper that you're counting.
I like this because it puts into context a lot of my thoughts. Actually, it's a real pleasure to talk to you, because one of the things that I've been saying for quite a while on this podcast and sort of mulling over is this concept that in safety we create a form for the sake of the form. So say I go into a company and I want an accident incident system, I will, you know, the cheapest way is find a form online that someone's got, generic accident incident form number one, and then I implement that into our system, and then that's that box ticked. But I've seen this many times where organizations are like recording all manner of details on an accident incident form. One, that's a barrier to employees completing it because it just looks too complicated. And two, it just doesn't, they don't need it. They don't need to know the humidity levels for in a retail outlet or a hotel or something for, you know, slips, trips and falls. You know, they don't need to know this level of detail. And yet we just inherit it. And we've always done that. You know, think back to accident books. It told you what to collect and you just did it.
Yeah.
It was never collected with analysis in mind. It was collected to meet the requirements of whatever the Social Security Act is in RIDDOR.
Yeah. And I love that idea as well. I mean, it brings us back to your perhaps your question on risk assessment. So That's one of my pet peeves is, you know, you're supposed to do a risk assessment at the point you're undertaking the activity. So how is somebody who's about to go and, you know, climb an electricity pylon going to do that risk assessment when that risk assessment's in a folder or a binder in an office? So this idea of technology and the way connectivity is working now so that you can have somebody at the point they're about to undertake a task, doing a dynamic risk assessment on a digital form that is customizable, that allows them to say, actually, it's more windy than normal here, and I'm going to put in an extra control because of the level of wind I'm seeing, or even in my nirvana, an ability to say, I'm unsure, here's some photos, here's some extra info that's going back to base. Somebody at base in a hierarchy can say, do you know what, against our previous experience of this, you're safe to continue. But for so many people, a risk assessment is a thing that's just signed at the bottom so that they can get on with their job, not an engaging piece of their job to help keep them safe or help the company ensure that they're safe. And I think that's a huge use case for where technology can assist. So dynamic mobile risk assessments at the point at which the risk is being faced, and enabling your employees to do that in a way that doesn't require a NEBOSH certificate, you know, allows them to do it in layman's terms, but using the technology to then frame that in a way that says, there's too much risk here. You know, your score is 25, therefore we want you to stop, remain where you are, go back to site or whatever, and almost build that engagement up so that the employee is doing what HSE properly want people to do, which is risk assess at the time they're doing it.
I think to summarize the data thing, because I want to move on to AI and ask your thoughts on AI, but to summarize the data thing, then I think I'm deciding that there's two sort of considerations. Let me pause. I'm going to delete this silence out. Well, I think
that's fine.
One is we've got an insufficient sample size in many organizations to actually analyze the data effectively. And two is the data is so messy that it's very hard to analyze effectively. Both, when you try to integrate into tech, are going to cause you problems if you haven't got this data right in the first place. I don't know. Yeah. How does that sound?
Absolutely. And data right in the first place is another bugbear. It absolutely is critical. So, you know, when we get to talking about AI and we talk about any analytics, it is absolutely pointless spending money on things which are going to produce beautiful graphs on something that's just nonsense at the beginning, which is why I go back to my data literacy first thing, really, Pete, is you need to have some understanding about how data is structured and what good data looks like. And you need to have data management as part of a role in safety in order that you can do anything with the output. And that's, you know, that's a reasonable overhead that I think people are going to have to recognize that they cover. But yeah, I think you're spot on in terms of the sample size of data that you're getting. And in that scenario, you're talking about technology tools being an enabler for, you know, automation and speeding things up. So we haven't talked about, and we can go on to AI, I guess, but for me, there's that, just that very simple point. I've got some of my customers, for example, when a certain event type is hit, that alerts the board. So this, what I love about what tech can do there is you've got your standard, yeah, it's a near miss, it's coming into a manager, it's coming into the safety team, whoever, but you've got that opportunity to say, this something here is sufficiently big that we want to escalate that immediately. And it's that immediacy that you can drive with technology now, where in the old, and I'm calling the olden days, but that's probably about 5 years ago, but where in the past you would fill a form in and it would eventually get to someone. And I remember really distinctly a meeting I had probably 2 years ago with an international business, and they'd had a very serious accident at one of their sites in another country. And I think they found out like the next year when they happened to visit. Now, that in a microcosm, I think, is what happens regularly in businesses, even in the UK, where something can happen on a Monday. Someone senior who should know about it might find out, you know, a week later. Well, where does that cover you in terms of your insurance? But more importantly, how well are you looking after the employee? Are your HR professionals, you know, jumping in there? So to your point, Pete, earlier about links between workplace injuries and suicide, you know, the quicker a company can support an employee after an event, the better. A quicker a company can get on the communication to the other employees and stakeholders and their customers, the better. And technology is a massive enabler to speed up that communication channel, you know, infinitely more quickly than some of the old practices of spreadsheets or even emails now, which are just generally not being read because there are just too many.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I tend to find as well that when you have something serious happen, emails tend to stop and it tends to be via telephone call. And it can be a lot harder to sort of communicate properly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Should we have a conversation about AI? Just because everybody is talking about it in terms of safety and technology. And, you know, I see it all over LinkedIn. There are a lot of concerns and questions and queries. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think, what are my thoughts?
By the way, that was a very broad question.
I guess I look at it at the moment a bit. It's like the hype, call it the hype and yike chart of, you know, you've got your early adopters. So you've got your people who see it as a massive opportunity. And then the mirror of that almost is those people seeing it as a huge risk, either an existential humankind risk or at least a jobs risk, i.e. we're all going to be replaced by computers. And I think part of my stance on it is around we're unfortunately losing our kind of educational system about the value of history. So, you know, we tend to treat these things now as, God, this is the first time we've ever experienced it. But of course it isn't. We've been through industrial revolution. We've had the weavers rebelling against the looms and automation. We've been through cycles where, you know, we invented the car. I was fascinated by the fact when we started having cars running around on the roads, that they would run over and kill people. And there would be mobs attacking the drivers of the cars, dragging them out and killing them because it was perceived as morally wrong that these vehicles were killing human beings. And somehow we've now come to the place where humans aren't allowed on the roads because that's where cars belong nowadays. And so society has to make choices, I think, and it will. We'll sort of figure it out. We'll need some rules. There'll be some people who do stupid things, and there'll be people who say it'll never catch on, and they'll feel a bit foolish down the line. I there's obviously power in AI. It's obviously not new. It's been around for quite a long time. It's been accelerated recently by the power of things like ChatGPT. And my view is it's massively valuable when you've got really good data. And one of the best use cases I've seen recently is in a business who's used AI to go back over their historical safety data, which was manual in spreadsheets, etc. And kind of use AI to tidy it up. I think that's a wonderful use case because, as I said earlier, if you've got rubbish data, your AI might well struggle, or it might give you poor insights. And if you haven't got data literacy, what your AI is telling you, you're not going to question it. That's a huge risk. I think that's a real risk. So I think my concern would be that we jump into trusting what the outputs are very rapidly without having the skills to control it. For me, it's a tool, and you need skills and training to use the tool. Like we've always said, I don't think there's new news in that. AI is a tool, very, very powerful, very big engine on it. You wouldn't let somebody go and drive a very big, powerful engined vehicle without some training. And I think that's where we need to help push our people. I'm not really a subscriber to the, you know, the existential risk. I totally empathize with people who might worry about losing their jobs. You know, I used to be an auditor at PwC long, long ago, not a very good auditor. You know, that job shouldn't exist in a few years' time. And I feel for people who want to be accountants who can't now get in through that role because AI is doing a whole load of that. Same with legal. You know, there are some big professions at risk. What I see is the opportunity side of that is, especially for safety, is the communication and the empathy that AI won't be able to do for a long time are the big things that set great safety people apart. You're being able to take what the AI tells you and turn that into something that influences hearts and minds is a huge skill set and an opportunity. And for me, if you take away the drudgery of managing data and spreadsheets and all the boring stuff, and you could spend 25% more of your week talking to your frontline employees, influencing your board, talking to investors, customers, I think that's an amazing place to get to. And if AI helps you get there, I'd be all for it. That was a long answer, Pete.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Honestly, it is really interesting. And I mean, I see this all the time, but I sort of feel as well that organizations have changed, you know, companies have changed. Someone said to me a while ago, they were like, well, safety is a people job. It's about having conversations. And I'm like, yeah, I agree with that up to a point, but you can only scale conversations so far. And you can't evidence outcome from conversations. You know, it's hard to. So I totally respect that it's part of the safety profession. But, you know, like years ago, I did some work in a foundry and, you know, it'd have had 200 staff. Most of them were on final salary pensions back in this would have been back in the 80s or something, or 70s. Yeah. By the way, it hadn't changed much since the 70s, to be honest. It was pretty much the same, very unionized. You know, it was like it's like going back in time. But yeah, the staff, 200 staff back in the 70s, most of them would have been on final salary pensions. They'd have all lived in the town. Their kids would have probably gone to work in the factory. Their wives would have probably worked in a part of the factory part-time. Do you know what I mean? It'd have been this very traditional organization. Well, fast forward to now, and it's not like that anymore. You know, staff turnover is high. Staff aren't in final salary pensions. You know, they leave often, you know, or they live overseas or come to work in that factory. And that's the thing with tech for me is it's like that's the checks and balances for me. It's hard, like I say, it's hard to evidence a conversation and it's easy to fake a conversation, but it's easy to evidence tech and it's hard to fake it. You know, the numbers speak for themselves if you get the numbers right.
Really, I think a really valid point as well about where we're going in reporting and ESG as well, Pete, like this data, you know, whether it's your currently, you know, the big focus on emissions, CO2 emissions being reported in board reports, but safety data as well. I think there's a whole new lens coming in on the quality of the data that companies are collecting. And you know, over in the States, they're already starting that auditing of safety data. So absolutely having it validated and digital is going to be critical in many aspects. And I think on your point on conversations, I completely get that. I think it's a brilliant point about you can't scale the conversations. And I think it's always going to be about an augmentation of a safety professional with technology and data. But where data can go to the next level is things like the predictive tech. So we have done some work with customers who have enough of a sample size, and that's absolutely relevant to what you said earlier, where we built proof of concepts, where we've run, this is them reporting a safety event. Can we predict that this is going to be an LTI, for example, or a RIDDOR? And we're talking thousands of events here. And without getting into the techie maths, which you probably know better than me, but I think the F number that we came out with in our proof of concept was like 97% or something. So very, very statistically high. In other words, we could show that on these events, we could predict incredibly accurately that's going to be an LTI. And there's an obvious value to the business in knowing before it's been reported as an LTI that it's going to be. Having said that, many, many, many of our customers won't have anywhere near enough data to be able to say on the, you know, on the 30 events a month, well, that one's going to be an LTI. So there is going to be some, I agree with you entirely, there's going to be some challenges on the data. And what I think AI is more valuable for in the short term is things like as somebody is completing that form in the first place, assume it's digital, but when they're completing it, to start to use AI to say, you know, are you sure you think that's a near miss? Because in the narrative, you've mentioned hurt or broken or snapped or whatever. So you've got some really, I think, quite innovative use cases that can be delivered much, much more quickly and without the worry for lots of data sets than the kind of, we're going to predict you're going to have an accident at 3 o'clock next Tuesday, which I think is quite fanciful.
Yeah, I agree. As we're talking, I'm sitting here thinking, why, say we take an industry like retail. I'm only saying retail because it's a fairly straightforward industry in terms of, you know, risk. would it be possible to start combining data sets, taking data from other retailers, other organizations in that same industry, anonymizing them and pulling them together?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've done some work exactly like that on builders merchants. We've got four of the six biggest builders merchants in the UK. We did some work on benchmarking to try and identify the group averages, the group performance, and then allow each individual entity to see, you know, where they compare. So you absolutely can. What I wouldn't underestimate, Pete, is I feel like you could get 10 safety people in a room and ask them to define what a near miss is. And that's a fairly basic thing, and get 10 different interpretations, and somebody that would say it's a near hit, or it's a close call, or it's a, you know, it's so for us. So I was looking at our data this morning. We've got 800,000 events, safety events reported on Notify on our platform. We've got over 200,000 audits, 150,000 actions. We've got a lot of data, but beneath that is the nuances that our customers have in terms of the type of event that they want to report, the way they want to report it. So there is a challenge. It's definitely doable, but you'd almost need to get those retailers in a room and say, can we form some kind of agreement across the schema of how things are named in order to combine that data? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Duncan, I'm aware that we haven't got too much time left, and it would be remiss of me not to ask you some questions from your experience as an FD. So yep. as a safety professional now, I'm seeing more and more safety professionals being invited into the board to present on a, you know, quarterly or a six-monthly basis. And I'm just wondering from your experience at that level, what we could do as safety professionals to make that process better.
Yeah.
Sorry, but not to make that process better. That sounds like a terrible question. To present to the board more effectively.
Yeah. Some obvious stuff is know the subject, and believe it or not, because I'm a finance person in the background, bring the data. So bring the evidence that you have and present it clearly and consistently, and allow the board to understand what it is that you're either outlining, advocating, or flagging. So clear communication based on evidence is absolutely, for me, the key. And understanding there are different, you know, there are different personalities with different agendas on the board. So understanding those and making sure that you're engaging with those people outside the board meeting is critical too. So, you know, the ones that I see, that the presentations I see, the interactions I see that are most valuable are driven by a degree of clarity. And I think that's sometimes hard because it can be quite emotive, health and safety. You know, you can perhaps find yourself in a, well, we have to do this, otherwise the CEO is going to prison. And whilst, of course, that is on one level correct, I think most boards will respond badly to what they will see as hyperbole. Where people, I think, will respond better is, this is our performance. This is the benchmark performance that I think we should be getting to. This is what our peer group are doing, and this is how we're comparing, and here's what I need in order to get us to where we've agreed, and here's my strategy to do it, and get people to buy into that. So it's influence through data, through clarity, and it's great communicating. I was reading, I think it's Adam Grant recently, another great book he's written, and that he was talking about that, using data to construct the argument and then deliver it, but recognize it's not just data, it's about empathy and emotion and buy people in. And I think the strongest performers that I've seen have managed to crack that, to understand the different agendas, but crack it, which is, you know, let's call it out, Pete, like operational people don't want their people off the tools or off the job being trained or wasting time on safety. You know, the sales director doesn't want their people not selling. The finance director doesn't really want to spend any more money, but might be influenced by things like the insurance cost and the risk. You know, the people director probably is going to buy into it, but will want to understand how that aligns to the people strategy. So it's making sure that you understand the different personas And I would also, I'd probably finish with nobble the CEO, you know, because it is them that's on the hook. I think that's the really powerful part of health and safety. And something that came home with COVID was, I think a lot of the CEOs looked round at their team and saw the health and safety leader as a key part of that solution to what COVID landed. And I would love to see more safety leaders using that new kudos to keep at the top table and keep developing their role there.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal insight, Duncan. Yeah. And I think I completely agree with you, by the way. You alluded to this before with sustainability. You know, sustainability, they bring the data now, they bring the facts and figures. Marketing team, you know, a marketing director will bring the facts and figures. There's no way they're going to ask for £100,000 put in Google ads and not know a clear rate of return, ROI, click-through rates, demographics, exposure. You know, they'll have all of this information, and finance have been doing it for years. And then, you know, I sort of fear that if we get to the top table and then we ask for something and say, look, can you invest your money in this and forget that the directors have this fiduciary duty, you know, and we just go, can we have this money? And they're like, why? And you go, well, you can't put a price on safety. It's just, it's not cutting it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. And I don't know if it did, but there are just, you know, better tools. And one of those is the forming of alliances across those key C-suite people. So investing the time to get to know them. And you know, finance did this a while ago where everybody became finance business partners overnight. You've got HR business partners. You know, whilst I was probably a bit cynical at the time, what I love about that is you align your operational people and your compliance people so that your compliance people are seen as working alongside it. And again, the opportunity for safety people is to be sitting there going, I've got all this safety data and I've been looking at how this operates. Did you know that we spend 30% of our week doing this thing, which if we did it differently, might save you headcount? You know, that's where you inspire your colleagues to go, flipping heck, it's not just health and safety and clipboards, it's operational insight that will help me not only be safer, but actually be more productive. That's where you get the massive kudos out of safety by influencing in other parts of the business that's not just the compliance badge.
Duncan, I'm aware that's your time and I know you're busy. Honestly, I appreciate you so much coming onto the podcast and sharing your insights with us today. It's very, very much appreciated.
No, it's a pleasure, Pete. I really, really enjoyed it. Hope it was useful and I've learned some good stuff from you too. So yeah, be good to catch up again sometime. And yeah, thanks for the opportunity as well.
No, honestly, thanks very much. If you enjoyed this episode, then please like and subscribe. It really does make a difference to the show. Thank you so much and see you in the next episode.